Morning, church. He is risen. This morning, what we're going to talk about is Christmas story. No, I'm just kidding. We're going to talk about Easter. And the fact that we're going to go through Matthew's account of the Easter story. And the fact that when it all comes down to it, when we look at the empty tomb, we can realize that he is not here. Meaning he's not in the tomb, he is not still dead, because he is risen. So we're going to be in Matthew 28, I'm going to go 1 and the verses following, on through the end of the story. Right? It says, "Now after Sabbath, as it began to dawn, toward the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary came to look at the grave. And behold, a severe earthquake had occurred, for an angel of the Lord descended from heaven and came and rolled away the stone and sat upon it. And his appearance was like lightning, and his clothing as white as snow. The guards shook for fear of him and became like dead men. The angel said to the women, 'Do not be afraid, for I know that you are looking for Jesus who has been crucified. He is not here, for he has risen. Just as he said, come, see the place where he was lying. Go quickly and tell his disciples that he is risen from the dead. And behold, he is going ahead of you into Galilee. There you will see him. Behold, I have told you.' And they left the tomb quickly with fear and great joy, ran to report to his disciples. Behold, Jesus met them and greeted them. And they came up and took hold of his feet and worshipped him. Then Jesus said, 'Do not be afraid. Go and take word to my brethren to leave for Galilee, and there they will see me.'" There's a lot in this story, right? Not just one verse or two. But what I want to really do is I want to look at, you know, there's a lot of differences in the four accounts of the resurrection. There's a lot of differences in who was there, what happened, all of that. And what I want to talk about is the fact that these aren't irreconcilable. These can be made into one clean, concise story. We just have to look at them all together. So, for women, right? In the story here, it records Mary and Mary. Right? Mark records three. Mary, Mary, and Salome. Luke records multiple. He just says they. John only records one. So how many was it? Well, John records the one that's important. That's the one that came and brought word of it back to Jesus' disciples. Right. Matthew, he records the two Marys. He skips Salome because who knows why. But he obviously did not feel that she was as important to the story. Mark records three of them. Because Mark is an account from Peter. Peter knew how many there were. He knew what was going on. And Luke just records they. Because as he says, I'm trying to give the best full explanation of everything that's going on. So how many was it? Well, what we're going to do is we're going to look at the common details. All the Gospels, they report that women found the tomb empty. So, in first century Israel, this would serve as the principle of embarrassment. If something's not true, why would you include an embarrassing detail? You have women witnessing to this. Women were, let's call it, less likely to be believed in a story. Not they were unbelievable, but they were less likely to be believed. They wouldn't have had the provenance of if a man had found it. Why didn't everybody just cut the women out and say Luke and John found it? Peter and John found it. Why didn't they? Well, because that wouldn't be the truth. The truth is that women found it. Okay? how many did the eyewitnesses see, right? So how many of these women did the eyewitnesses see at that moment, right? John, he only records Mary. Why? Because Mary was the first one. As soon as Mary got there, he took off. Right? It says that he and Peter basically raced to the tomb. And he beat Peter. But he didn't go in. Peter went in. Right? But these stories, they don't contradict each other. They complement each other. When we're talking about Jesus' crucifixion, Jesus is being beaten by Roman soldiers. Right? As he's being beaten, you know, Matthew doesn't tell you that his face is covered. Right? So he's being beaten, and they say, "Prophesy to us who hit you." But you have to go into the book of Luke to find out that he's wearing a blindfold. Matthew never tells you that. So these stories don't contradict each other. They've got a different detail in there. That doesn't mean it's contradictory. It makes it complementary. It builds on each other. So once again, with the angels, Matthew records one angel, Mark records one angel, Luke records two angels, and John says that there are multiple. How many angels were there? Well, we don't know for sure, but these stories complement one another. It's not an actual contradiction. If I say I saw one person in the car, right? All I saw was the driver because the two people in the back seat were leaned over, does it mean that I'm wrong? What I saw was wrong? Did I tell a lie? No. I just didn't have all the details. Right? My story is not wrong. It's from my perspective. Right? When we talk about the Bible being, you know, God-breathed, means that the men who wrote the Bible were inspired by God to write it. Not that that's all it is it's, you know, God wrote it. No, God inspired it. It's inspired by Him. Right? Men still wrote it from their points of view and their perspectives. And that's how we know we can trust it. So this is what a tomb would have looked like, right? It would have had basically a row on the inside here where people could walk in when they were carrying a body. It would have the individual wrapped in linen, right? So they would have had a face cloth and then linen. And there would have been areas for multiple people. Then there would be a little railway basically here, where you could pry this stone into place over the front of the tomb. Now, these were tombs for the wealthier, the higher class people, right? Not for your everyday person. So when Joseph of Arimathea gave his family tomb to Jesus to be buried in, we can see that that accounts for how Jesus was put in a tomb. Jesus was not wealthy. He was an itinerant preacher. So this is the kind of the makeup of the tomb that they would have been looking at. So this stone, instead of being in place over this, would have to be pried open by 2 to 3 individuals, most likely, possibly even more. Right? The question is how did the stone move? Right? If the stone's not in place, how did it move? How did it get from being over the doorway, the entryway, to not? That took a few people to do. Would have required multiple men, and it would have also been guarded. We've got Roman guards standing in front of this door. You know what the punishment was for falling asleep on watch? Oh man, that'd be bad. Die. They would kill you. Right? Today, if somebody falls asleep on watch, largely, they just get yelled at. In that day, oh, they'd kill you. They would run you through with a sword or a spear, or even crucify you. Or you'd find the quickest way to remove your head from your shoulders. Right? But the Gospels record that the stone had been moved by the angels. So the stone is no longer in place. So the guards are only recorded in the book of Matthew. Four accounts of it, the guards are only recorded in one place. Why is that? Well, because Matthew is the only one who was really concerned with what the authorities were actively saying about the missing body. His narrative is written to the Jewish people so that they can understand what's going on. Who is this Jewish Messiah? So he's writing his story to the Jewish people, and they would have heard stories of the body having been stolen. Peter's writing to whoever, right? John is writing to combat heresy in the church. And Luke is just giving an overall account, but it's mostly for the non-Jewish people. So he's really not talking about the fact that the Jewish authorities in Jerusalem are saying that the bodies were stolen. Matthew was worried about that, because Matthew is writing to those who were there. He's writing to those who were in Jerusalem at the time of his letter. Right? So, if there were guards, who were they and how many? Right? There are good reasons to believe that they were Roman, and there are good reasons to believe that they were Jewish temple guards. But the question, and we don't really have 100% on it. We don't know how many, really. It just says guards. Guards would have most likely been in four-man shifts, probably in 4 8-hour shifts, right? Actually, two groups of four in each 8-hour shift, right? So you'd have your six watches, first watch, second watch, third watch, onto the sixth watch, and then it would start over, right? But these questions are unanswered in the text, right? So do we actually know how many we're guarding? No. Why don't we? Because the text is silent with regards to it. It's not try to make the Bible say things it doesn't say. Right? But the fact remains that there were indeed guards at the tomb. And this slide says Jesus, and there's nothing. So the fact is the women have come to anoint the body. Right? They were kind of rushed in getting him wrapped up and put in the tomb so that the tomb could be sealed before nightfall. Because the Passover was starting. Passover started nightfall of Friday. He had to be in the grave before then. 100% had to be in the grave before then. So the women, they've mixed up their spices. They finished that up on Friday. Right? And now it's Sunday morning. And they're ready to go and anoint the body. Put the spices on it so it doesn't smell so bad. That's what they're trying to do. They're trying to get the body anointed. And they go, and this is what they find when they're looking for Jesus. They find nothing. He's not there. The tomb is empty. Whatever way you want to try to explain away the empty tomb, there are a million ways to explain it, but only one makes sense with everything that follows, and that is Jesus rose from the dead. The death did not defeat him. As Paul writes in 1 Corinthians 15:55, O death, where is your sting? Oh hell, where is your victory? It has no victory. It did not win against Jesus. Right? the angel, he looks at Mary and he says, "He is not here." She says, "Where have you taken him? He is not here." And their next statement says it all. He is risen. He is risen. This is on the third day. On the third day, he is risen. On the third day, but it was Friday. Now it's Sunday. That doesn't mean on the third day. Okay, so the Jewish days start different than the normal American days, or pretty much anywhere else. Right? So, until sunset, you're at Friday. At sunset Friday, day one is complete. Right? So Friday, day one, that's the first day. Saturday, the full day that Jesus is in the tomb, the second day. Day two, the second day. Sunday is the third day. Somewhere after sunset on Saturday. Because that's when Sunday actually begins, is sunset on Saturday. On the third day. And this is according to the scriptures, as Paul writes in 1 Corinthians 15. Right? He raised on the third day, according to the scriptures. This is God's history of providing redemption on the third day. He shows us it a lot, right? Look at Isaac. Genesis 22, 4-5 says, on the third day, right? He went out to camp with his son, Isaac. Camping, right? On the third day, Abraham raised his eyes and saw the place from a distance. Abraham said to his young men, "Stay here with the donkey. I and the lad will go over there, and we will worship and return to you." That's Genesis 22, 4-5, right? His intention was to go and provide Isaac as a sacrifice. But God provided another one. On the same hill, about 1,500 years later, another father had the same choice with his son, but he did not provide another sacrifice because his son, Jesus, was the only sacrifice that would suffice. No, the redemption comes on the third day. Moses. Right? The Lord said to Moses, "Go to the people and consecrate them today and tomorrow. Let them wash their garments. Let them be ready for the third day. For on the third day, the Lord will come down on Mount Sinai in the sight of all the people." It's Exodus 19, 10 and 11. God's desire was to be with His people. God still desires to be with His people. And He came, and He was with His people. Hosea writes, "Come, let us return to the Lord." Let us return to the Lord. How many people in our society don't get this? They don't say, "Oh, you know, I'm good. I don't need God. Have you seen the mess we're in? We definitely need God. More now than ever. Come, let us return to the Lord. For He has torn us, but He will heal us. He has wounded us, but He will bandage us. He will revive us after 2 days. He will raise us up on the third day, that we may live before Him." We will live with God on the third day. That's what that says. He will revive us on the third day. He did revive us on the third day. He revived us. He brought us all the way back from our fracture, from Adam and Eve, to Him. When the tomb was empty. When the stone was gone. It's important that we realize that. And how about Jesus' own statement regarding the third day? But He answered and said to them, "An evil and adulterous generation craves for a sign, and yet no sign will be given to it, but the sign of Jonah the prophet. For just as Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the belly of the sea monster, so will the Son of Man be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth." It's Matthew 12, 39 to 40. Jesus is saying, "I'm going to be in the grave. 3 days." So here's some reasons to accept why we can know that the tomb was empty. Number one, this whole business happened in Jerusalem. Where would they want to disprove it most? Jerusalem. They don't want this to be true. They don't want Jesus to be right and they were wrong. They'd do anything to have that not be the case. Number two, women found it. So we have a location. Now we have this embarrassment portion, right? Women found it. Testimony of women is less than stellar. Considered less than stellar in the courts even. But women found it. Then, everybody goes rushing. Right? Everybody knows where this tomb is. It's not like it's a secret hiding place. It's a rich man's tomb. Joseph of Arimathea. He's a wealthy individual. His tomb is known. Everybody knows where this is. So there are many witnesses. Paul infers that it's empty by saying that Jesus was dead. Now He is raised. They anticipated it to be a bodily resurrection. So, in Paul saying that He is raised from the dead, it means He's no longer in the grave. And if you read Justin Martyr and Tertullian, you can see that Jewish leaders at this time, in the 2nd and 3rd century, are still trying to explain how the tomb got empty. They're trying to say, "Oh yeah, the disciples stole the body. Oh yeah, this. Oh yeah, that." So if they're trying to explain something away, it makes sense that it's empty. And He says, "Tell them to go to Galilee." The angel said, right? Jesus wanted to meet with His apostles in Galilee because it was the training grounds that were used to prepare these 11 men in the work of building the brotherhood of all mankind and to teach this new religion of the Spirit. It was the home of the apostles. Paul writes, he says, "Now if Christ is preached that He has been raised from the dead, how do some among you say that there is no resurrection of the dead? But if there is no resurrection of the dead, not even Christ has been raised. And if Christ has not been raised, then our preaching is in vain. Your faith also is in vain." If Christ has not been raised, then our faith is worthless. If Easter did not happen, Christianity does not matter. There's nothing to it. It's empty. Just like the tomb. If Jesus isn't raised, then none of what we're doing makes a difference. That's what Paul's basically saying there, right? It's empty or void. If Christ has not been raised, then our faith is empty. Paul continues and he says, "And if all this is true, if all this is false, then we above all men are to be most pitied." why the resurrection is such an important part of our faith. That's why there's so many books on why the resurrection, or that the resurrection matters, is because it's the only thing that truly matters in our faith. I had a friend of mine, he said that there are two things that matter in Christianity. One, that God exists. Two, that Jesus is raised from the dead. All the rest simply follows from that. If Christianity is to be true, Christ must be raised from the dead. And they worshipped Him. Right? They worshipped Jesus because of all of this. Right? These women, they fell at Jesus' feet and they worshipped Him. The men were to fall at Jesus' feet and worship Him. Right? Thomas wasn't with the disciples when Jesus initially shows up. Right? They're all shuttered in. Right, the doors are locked. They don't want anybody coming in. But Jesus comes amongst them. And they're like, whoa, Jesus was here. And Thomas is like, yeah, right, show me. Until I stick my fingers in the hands in the holes in his hands and put my hand in the spear mark in his side, I will not believe. Jesus comes amongst them. And there's Thomas with them. And he says, he said to Thomas, reach here with your finger and see my hands. Reach here with your hand and put it into my side. Do not be unbelieving, but believing. Do not be untrusting in who I am, but be trusting in who I am. Thomas answered and said to him, my Lord and my God. The Lord of me, the God of me. You are Lord whether I want you to be or not, whether I believe you are or not. My God, the God of me. You are God whether I want you to be or not. Jesus said to him, because you have seen me, have you believed? He doesn't say, Thomas, you've spoken wrongly. I'm not God. No, he says, because you've seen me, you've believed. Blessed are they who did not see and yet have believed. It's John 20, 27 to 29. It all comes down to worshiping God rightly. We have to worship God rightly. We are worshiping a Savior who is risen, not someone who is dead, but a living God. That's the most important part for us to understand as we continue in our faith. And we continue to go forth on this Easter, we have to realize that Jesus is God and He is to be worshipped as such. It doesn't mean twice a year, Christmas and Easter. That means every single day. Okay, let's pray. God, thank you for giving us the technical abilities to be able